tell us where you stand on issues. And for
well,
some reason,
done
Ashley,
that. I'm not
she
sure
hasn't
why you
done
haven't
that.
Seen that.
No, she hasn't,
I've got
Ashley.
A list here just
no,
of some
Ashley,
of her recent
no, she
Do you
hasn't.
Want to hear it, Congressman? Do you want to hear it? Or do you just want to rail on me?
Hey, Ashley.
I've got the list
no,
here. She
Ashley,
talked about the Supreme
Ashley.
Court health care hearing in June 28th. She talked at length about the contentious climate in Washington on May 2012. She talked about health care reform on 2012. She talked about the economy, food stamps.
Good morning and welcome back to our concluding segment in our series, Agreeing to Disagree, Civility in Public Discourse. As we've discussed over the past 2 days, civility is about more than just politeness. It is about disagreeing without disrespect, seeking common ground as a starting point for dialogue about differences, listening past one's preconceptions, and teaching others to do the same. In our previous segments, we explored how we sometimes succeed and often fail at civility. In our final segment, we present Civility, an Exercise in Getting Along. We welcome two scholars for an in-depth panel discussion to discuss what the beginning steps are for improved civility in our politics, discourse, and search for common ground. We are opening our phone lines, and we welcome your perspective. 1-800-348-2551. We'll be going to the calls in about 15 minutes or so, but feel free to get on the line early. 1-800-348-2551. And a reminder, this program is funded in part by Mass Humanities, state-based affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities, www.masshumanities.org. Let me introduce our two special guests. Austin Sarrett is the William Nelson Cromwell Professor of Jurisprudence and Political Science and Chair of Political Science at Amherst College. We also welcome David Smith, the John W. Chandler Professor of English at Williams College, and it is a pleasure to have you both in our studio this morning. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having us, Drew.
Thank you.
So, Austin, let us begin with you. We've been talking about the subject over the past 2 days, and one of the things that we learned very early as we took on this project of how many different aspects there are, how many different facets there are to this issue and to the problem. You come to this from a political science basis, and I'm curious if there's kind of a mission statement and ultimately how you feel about the subject. I'm interested in keying in on that.
Sure. I would say the following. The conversation about civility is a compelling one. It's a compelling one because the symptoms of incivility are all around us. But I worry sometimes that civility is a magnet, and it draws attentions away from other problems, which are themselves responsible for breaches of civility. So it may be that instead of thinking about civility as a primary political problem, we need to think about civility as a symptom of some other, let's say, deeper political problems. It may be that we have breaches of civility because we have growing and great gaps in income inequality. It may be that we have breaches of civility because we have real and important differences about fundamental issues of values in the United States. So I think it's important to keep the conversation about civility in a broader context. And again, let me just say, that's not to say that civility and incivility is not an important subject. It is. But it is to say that as we think about civility, we want to think about the context in which these breakdowns in civility occur.
So often it can become a result of the larger problem. And in other words, it's sort of an item in our utility belt that we incivility in which we can use as a result of these other factors.
I think that's exactly right. And the problem or sometimes the temptation is to think that civility and incivility is itself the underlying problem, when in truth the breakdown of civility may be a symptom of other problems that need to be addressed.
Professor David Smith, after listening over the last 2 days and hearing, what are your thoughts on the subject as we enter this conversation?
First of all, I would agree pretty much entirely with what Austin just said. I would reiterate the point in some slightly different terms. I think that oftentimes focusing on civility results from a desire to address the problem of political dysfunction and people's inability to work together politically. But I think it's a serious mistake to confuse causes and effects. I don't think that the breakdown in civility is a cause of political dysfunction. Rather, I think that the increasing amount of political uncooperativeness derives from a changing consensus about the nature of politics and the desirability of a kind of liberal humanist concept of participation and cooperation. I think we have a politics now that's emerging in the country that, on one side of the ledger at least, really wants to think of the function of government differently, the role of function, the role of government in the lives of Americans in different terms. And that fundamental disagreement causes people not to be interested in cooperating with each other because they really are pursuing different goals. So I think that the breakdown of civility is not the cause of that. It is a symptom of a profound disagreement.
So let's talk about breakdown for a moment, because one of the things that has really struck me over the past 2 days is that we've had voices on this program, Steven Pinker being one, Jonathan Haidt being another, of saying, look, when you take this as a large issue, violence has decreased. We are actually becoming more civilized. Even Randall Kennedy said this yesterday. We are becoming more civilized over time. And yet, when we took our microphones to libraries in Springfield and in North Adams, Massachusetts, and talked to scores of people, average citizens at the library on a April and May afternoon, said, look, we don't feel like we live in a civilized society anymore. We see it eroding. We see it breaking down. So with those two very different pictures, how do we kind of put that into a perspective and say, okay, if we are becoming more civilized, then why do so many people feel that is not the case for them personally and as part of our society?
So it's hard to have the perspective of hundreds of years in mind when you're interviewed in a public library in Springfield or North Adams. So yes, if you take the broad picture, the long view, it's quite clearly the case that the ways in which we live today are governed by stronger norms of civility. But most people don't live in the perspective of hundreds of years. They live in the moment. And I think that there's ample evidence around us that in the short term, if you kind of tamp the lens down, let's say looking over the last 50 years, that politics, political life, and social life in the United States has changed dramatically. If you go back to the 1950s, people in political science and history proudly proclaimed that the United States was a different kind of political system. We had a consensus, whereas in Europe, in Italy, and in France, these were divided polities. Today, I think it feels that our politics have become more like the politics of France and Italy in the 1950s, where positions are polarized, people have moved to the extreme. That's what people feel. And the only other point I would make is that civility and breaches of civility have gotten a lot of public attention. Mm. So this program is not about growing income inequality. It's about civility. And as our polity has become more inclusive, as more voices have come to the table and more values have been brought to the table, you would expect that there would be increasing conflicts. And that's actually a sign, in a way, of the health of our political system, not just its dysfunction.
David Smith.
Well, I think that if you talk to ordinary people, they do have a sense that something is amiss.
Right.
And clearly, there are fundamental changes happening in America. We see this shifting of wealth upwards, the actual prospects of people being able to raise their standing, their economic standing, by working hard and playing by the rules, have in fact diminished. The globalization of the economy has changed the nature of labor markets and opportunity. And so people do feel that the society is leaving them behind, because it is. And I think that for some people, it's okay to leave more people behind. The idea of striving to be one people is not as desirable to everybody as it used to be. And I know there's always been rancor. We're a country that had its own civil war. There have been differences. But I think that something different is happening now, which is that, if we put it in terms of race, it's not just about black people, but white working people have been impoverished. They have no opportunity to use their education to do work that they were trained to do, and so are forced to take jobs that are beneath them in terms of aspiration and skill in order simply to survive. That does constitute a social crisis, and it's not resolved yet. That process is still happening. I think people in the academic world are more buffered from that than most people, and so the sense of deep crisis is perhaps not as sharp on our campuses as it is if you just walk a few blocks and talk to people who earn wages.
We welcome your phone calls, 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, and we will be going to those phone calls in just a moment. In picking up what you just said, I was struck by a comment from one of the patrons at the library in North Adams that said there feels that many people come into a situation, into a relationship and into a conversation with a sense of entitlement, and that they were saying that they felt that was something that had changed, that people felt more entitled because just of what you mentioned. They're working harder, they're doing more, they're getting paid in some cases less, and yet there's that sense of entitlement that, okay, because I've done this, I should at least be able to receive what I want at this time. And perhaps that's at the jeopardy of the person on the other side of the equation. Do you think that's a fair analysis?
Well, I wouldn't put it quite that way. I think that the ideological urging to Americans traditionally has been that if you work hard, if you play by the rules, if you have discipline, you will succeed. And there were tracks people could be on, and they could imagine moving upwards, earning more money, having higher social standing on the track that they were on, whether it's through blue-collar work, and you could be a worker, and then you could be a foreman, and so forth. You could become a manager in certain kinds of businesses. So there was a way to move upward. I think it's all very uncertain now in a time when businesses shut down so rapidly, workers arrive to their job and find the doors locked. And that plays out in so many ways across the culture. So it really is an economic difference that has a sharper edge on it than it's had since the 19th century, I think. And I think most Americans are bewildered by it.
May I just say, I'm sympathetic to the person who said about someone else that they felt that other person presented themselves with a sense of entitlement. But again, I think we need to look at the basic social facts of life in 21st century America. And those basic social facts tell us some things, which is this society is increasingly segregated. It's segregated on class lines. It's segregated on racial lines. And there's lots of evidence it's increasingly segregated on political lines. There was a Pew poll that was just released in which people were asked to identify their political party affiliation, and they were identified as liberals and conservatives. And then they were asked how they would feel if a member of their family married someone of a different political affiliation. And there was evidence in this Pew poll that people on both ends, liberals and conservatives, would be upset if a member of their family married someone of a different political affiliation. Well, when I grew up, you might have heard that about religion, but I don't think you ever would have heard about it as, you know, you've betrayed the family, you've married a Republican. So I think this increasingly segregated life that we lead, in which we affiliate most with like-minded people and people like us, mean that when we encounter someone with a different point of view, we may hear their legitimate expression as tinged with a sense of entitlement. It doesn't feel like the people who we hang out with generally speak.
Austin Sarrett is our guest, as well as David Smith. Austin Sarrett is the Nelson Cromwell Professor of Jurisprudence and Political Science and Chair of Political Science at Amherst College. David Smith is the John Chandler Professor of English at Williams College. We welcome your phone calls. We'll be going to them when we come back. 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-34-TALK-1, 1-800-348-2551. We'll continue with our series, Agreeing to Disagree, Civility in Public Discourse, after this short break.
My nightmare is my daughter's having anything to do with a person driving drunk. That's my nightmare. Okay. It could be a Jewish drunk.
But this
it could be
guy
a
didn't
Polish
have to
drunk.
Be here.
It could be an Irish drunk.
No.
It could be an Italian drunk.
American
what the
crime,
hell difference does it make?
It makes plenty of difference.
It does not.
He
Bill,
doesn't
please.
Have a right to
he
be here.
He didn't commit a felony.
He doesn't have a right to be in this country.
What? But that has nothing to do with the
yes,
fact that he
does.
Was a drunk.
He should have been
he
deported.
Was a drunk. What
if, he should have been deported. And this mayor and a police chief didn't deport him.
Listen. Do you know how many people we have in jail?
Welcome back to our roundtable discussion on civility, agreeing to disagree, civility in public discourse, this final installment, Civility, an Exercise in Getting Along. The program is funded in part by Mass Humanities, state-based affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities, masshumanities.org. We'll go to the phone calls. We welcome your phone calls as well. 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-34-TALK-1, 1-800-348-2551. We begin with Maeve in Saugerties. Good morning. Thank you very much for being a part of the discussion.
Hi, how are you?
Doing fine.
Well, I wanted to say that, so I used to be a college professor, and now a lot of my work involves facilitating meetings and facilitating discussions, often among very diverse groups who disagree with one another. And we always set ground rules when we start a discussion, especially if it's a difficult topic, like teaching about gender or teaching about economic inequality, things like that. And one of the rules that I think is most important is the rule that you only volunteer yourself. And this means something different in different contexts. In the classroom, the way that I ended up defining it with my students was that it meant that you either tell your own story or you cite research, right? But that you avoid telling other people's stories and talking about those people, whoever you think those people might be. And I noticed in the clips that you guys were airing of people being very uncivil with one another, there was a lot of that kind of those people talk. And so I think that that's an important thing to remember if you want to have the conversations that can allow us to solve problems like economic inequality, is we have to actually be able to communicate with each other and not volunteer other people, only volunteer yourself.
It's an interesting point. Maeve, thank you very much for sharing with us. I think there's two things to be taken there. One is this idea of ground rules, and I think one of the things that we've discussed over the past 2 days is that inherent in our culture and our society and even in our beings that we have some of these ground rules that are set for society. But that idea of never but only volunteering yourself is an interesting notion.
I think it's a great notion, but I also think it's a notion that works best in a classroom or in a facilitated conversation. It's hard to enforce that notion when you're not in a classroom and you're not in a facilitated conversation. It's a good norm of a kind of personal integrity to speak about what you know in your own life and not attribute things to others. And the fact of the matter is there are ground rules that govern the way in which we talk to each other, and the setting matters a lot. Barack Obama, in an interview with Bill O'Reilly, said the following. He said, as far as the news media is concerned, the ground rule is that disagreement gets coverage.
Right.
Agreement gets no coverage. So if you want to talk about the ground rules with which we speak to each other, we need to broaden the conversation beyond the classroom and beyond the facilitated conversation to look at the various settings in which attention is garnered and how that attention is garnered. And all too often, the way to garner attention is to be loud and aggressive.
I mean, the clip we just played was Bill O'Reilly, and we've been playing some of these clips, to give ideas of incivility, and also because you don't usually hear that much yelling on public radio, so it's kind of fun to use it. And I always say it's not that it's better or worse. I don't want to make that classification, but it certainly is different, and is. You point out, Austin, I mean, it is something that people tune in for to see that tearing apart, where there are other news media outlets, ourselves included, I think, that people go because there isn't all of that yelling. And is that just preference, or is it a little bit more than that, do you think, David?
Well, I agree that if you're in a certain kind of setting, if you're in a classroom or if you're in a social club or organization or a church, people there have something in common, that they're there because they want to participate in a shared enterprise.
Right.
And they have their own interest in that. But what makes it worthwhile to participate is the sense that everybody benefits by cooperating. I think that's one of the things that's broken down in our politics, that there is a sharp sense now, especially from the more conservative side of the ledger, of politics as a zero-sum game. It's not about a shared commitment to doing what's best for the American people. It's about my side wins, your side loses. That's all that it's really about. If you win, you get to impose your agenda. If you lose, you can only cooperate with the other side, and you don't want to do that because it's all about winning. And I think that's it's a change. There's always some of that in politics anywhere, anytime. But I think we've taken a sharp turn in recent years, and that produces a lot of this dysfunction that is failure to cooperate and therefore to do what we think that government should do. But also the lack of desire to be civil to each other in terms of how you behave, how you speak, and so forth. The sense is the other side is your enemy. You're not sharing a common objective.
May I just say, I think we really need to be careful, because there are areas of American life in which great progress has been made, in which what David Smith just rightly noticed, that there is a sense of that there's something shared, there's a shared commitment, that we've seen great progress. We've seen great progress in domains of civil rights. We've seen great progress in the domain of gay marriage. We've actually seen great progress in the argument about capital punishment in the United States.
Right.
So I think that as we think about the areas of breakdown, and there are multiple, we also want to think about areas in which the things that we shared in common are clear and in which progress has been made.
1-800-348-2551, 1-800-34-TALK-1 is our telephone number. We welcome your phone calls. We go back to the calls and go to Peter, who joins us. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning. What I like about what you're talking about, I guess we focus more on the agreeing to disagree end of the spectrum,
yes,
simply because in our current day politics, basically that's what you have. You know, they're forced into it going in a way, between the Republicans and Democrats. It allows for, if you're already agreeing to disagreeing, the issue is the thing that has to come out, and that's in the end the truth anyway. So it allows for radical thought to be brought up by either party, and I think to actually keep balance, that needs to happen, and I think we've been too anesthetized as a society to bring up anything sort of too controversial. Case in point, you know, the political system in general. It seems, since it's so divided, it has to be looked at that's being sort of used as a meaning the system can be viable by the top 1%.
Peter, you're breaking up a little bit, but I think I get the point of the question, and it's an interesting one, which is that we become anesthetized, and then how do you move if there is that radical thought to move you ahead to have the entire conversation and ultimately action to move ahead? How do you do that?
So, and again, this David Smith used this word earlier. At an earlier point, again, I'm going to go back 50 years ago, it used to be said about American politics that our politics was not very ideological. And in fact, there was great overlap between the political parties. So you had liberal Republicans and conservative Democrats. Today, our politics has become much more ideological, and there's much less overlap between the political parties. And so therefore, it's just a little harder to agree to disagree when you have this politics becoming much more ideological, in which it becomes about first principles,
right,
not about things that we can easily compromise about. And it's hard to envision an easy way to back away from a politics which is has become so so ideological. But I do think what David Smith said earlier is right. To make progress, we need to identify areas in which we have shared commitments, in which there are things that we can say that we can agree about, even if at a very abstract level, and then work from those shared commitments to try to work out concrete solutions.
David Smith, why do you think that's so hard to make that next step? You would think it would be easy because you're starting off at some place of common ground.
I think it's hard. Austin was talking about context before, and context matters a lot. If you're talking in the context of, let's say, the American people broadly or in communities, I think that, in fact, there is a lot of ability of people, ordinary folk, to talk to each other, more so than in much of our history. And when you look at the changing opinions of Americans on a lot of hot-button issues, for example, homosexuality. We've seen an extraordinary shift in public opinions about people's right to express their sexual preference, to even to marry. I've been shocked, I think most of us have been shocked, at how quickly the public tide has turned. If you look at our politics in Washington, you don't see that it's the same thing happening. What you see is people dug in on one side or the other, or not a sense of anybody coming around, changing their position, being willing to listen to the other side with seriousness and respect. And so I think Austin was saying we need to particularize. I think it's important also to try to be precise where we're directing our attention. Mm. And we should pay more attention to what are the currents among the broad public, as opposed to the elites in our politics, because when we look at the elites, it's a very depressing picture.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation and continue with the phone calls. We welcome your call, 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-34-TALK-1. Our final installment, Civility and Exercise in Getting Along, part of our three-part series, Agreeing to Disagree, Civility and Public Discourse. You can hear the entire series by going to our website, wamc.org/roundtable, wamc.org/roundtable. The program is funded in part by Mass Humanities, state-based affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities, masshumanities.org. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.
We made the point. We support it. Your guys don't. That's outrageous
one
to oppose this bill.
Then we've got to go. And here's my question to Peter King.
Rather than save lives, yeah.
We voted. I got 94% of my colleagues. What percent did you get? How did that WHIP organization go? How's that Cracker Jack Peter King WHIP organization working out?
Welcome back to Agreeing to Disagree, Civility in Public Discourse. We welcome your phone calls, 1-800-348-2551. Let me reintroduce our guest this morning. David Smith is the John Chandler Professor of English at Williams College, and Austin Sarrett is the William Nelson Cromwell Professor of Jurisprudence and Political Science and Chair of Political Science at Amherst College. Again, we welcome your comments. 1-800-348-2551. We go back to the phone calls and go to Rachel in Leverett. Rachel, go ahead.
Yeah, and good morning, Joe, and thank you so much for this incredibly important conversation that you're having.
Appreciate that. Thank you.
Yeah. So here's what happens. I listen to these conversations that you guys are having, and I listen to the entrance clips that you put on with these people yelling at each other, you know, whomever they are. It sort of doesn't matter the details. I actually feel sick to my stomach. My heart races. I'm wondering about the bigger question of how our collective sort of neuroscience is being affected, what kinds of increased levels of adrenaline and cortisol we're all carrying as a result of this level of incivility, whether you're in the barbershop and you're listening to Fox News or some other organization screaming at each other, whether just the energy in the air that we're living in now is affecting us physically and physiologically.
I think you make two excellent points. One, oddly enough, it does seem every time I go to the barbershop that Fox News is on. I don't know why that is, but you make that point. I think it's interesting. Two is, why do you think we get so angry so quickly? Why is that a switch is thrown and we can go from 0 to 60 that quickly?
I think it's an amygdala hijack. I think literally, I think that we go into lizard brain and we sort of go, oh my God, he's attacking me. Oh my God, there's a threat. And we don't stay in our prefrontal cortex. We don't stay in that place of reason and logic and order. We don't question. We shut down. We don't hear the other person. We don't try and find out what might be right about what the other person is saying, where we might have some connection. And I think that too much of this, it becomes easy. We like I said, we go back to lizard brain. At least this is what I make up. So I'm just curious about what your panelists, what these august gentlemen think of this.
All right. Rachel, thank you very much for the phone call. I appreciate your input. Austin Sarah.
Well, I'm not often called an august gentleman, and that sort of excited some part of my brain, and I thank you for that. I do think there is something to be said for this perspective, which is that there is a kind of physiology to this, the way in which we are stimulated in certain kinds of conversations, but again, I want to resist the "we" in that description. There are contexts in which people are not immediately going from 0 to 60 in opposition to others. I think we need to identify what those contexts are, and again, I'm going to mention one that I'm particularly interested in as a case study. And that's about the hottest of hot-button issues, and that's the death penalty in the United States.
Right.
Conversation about the death penalty in the United States has changed dramatically in the last 15 or 20 years. And how has it changed? Well, it's changed because it's become, in fact, less polarized. We have been able to identify values that we share. I may be in favor of the death penalty, but I'm against executing the innocent. I may be in favor of the death penalty, but I'm against executing people on the basis of the race of their victim. And if we can find ways to maybe go to a somewhat more abstract level to identify places where we actually agree, then the stimulation that was wonderfully described by your caller that we get when we see these contests and we hear these yelling, I think there are evidence that we can escape that.
David Smith.
Well, I think what Austin just said is very, very well put, and I have nothing to add to that. I would say, just to speak to another aspect of the question, that I think that this kind of hysteria has been encouraged. I mean, Joe mentioned Fox News, and there's been a great turn in the nature of information commentary, political commentary on television. A generation ago, the 6 o'clock news was a common way of getting information about what was happening in the world. And on those programs, despite differences in the political leanings of the networks and the anchors and so forth, there was a commitment to presenting information in a dispassionate and fact-oriented way. And that's been displaced, and now what we have is that word ideological. What used to be on the fringe has been brought to the center, and what was in the center has virtually vanished. And so the making of consensus around a reasonable way of speaking to each other has been pushed aside, and instead what we get is the foregrounding of highly manipulative, emotional kinds of commentary. And I think that also undermines people's ability to not only to communicate with other people, but to gain a kind of inner calm and to think rationally themselves. Instead, they're encouraged to emote over issues. And of course, that doesn't produce anything constructive.
May I just say, I'm trying to figure out whether I'm the optimist in this conversation. And there's a way in which I guess I feel that I am. I think in some ways the problem of incivility is it's an attractive lightning rod. But I think the problems that we need to address are just different. And I think there are lots of places in the society in which we live in which progress is being made on a variety of questions. That doesn't mean that these other issues, the yelling that we hear in the background, it isn't real. It doesn't mean that political polarization isn't real. But I do think that there's a tendency to go into a kind of hysteria about the problem of incivility, and I think we need to resist that.
But what I find fascinating is that that's the perception. If you, when talking to the people in the library, that's the perception, is that they feel that they are being, as David said, that center is being is vanishing. So if you feel that you weren't a part of the conversation because you're not yelling louder than the other person, then isn't that a problem?
Well, I do think it is a problem if people feel unheard.
I think that's right.
But again, I want to reference something I said earlier. The fact is that the United States in 2014 is in some ways a more inclusive society. We're a more diverse society. And with that inclusiveness and with that diversity comes a kind of price. And that price is sometimes a lack of mutual understanding. And that's the context in which I think we need to keep in mind when you say, as you rightly say, that people feel unheard.
So you can be our august optimist.
I accept the title, anything with august. Easy, I'm easy with that.
Let's go to the phones. We go to Jack in Winnington, Massachusetts. Jack, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for letting me try to join this. I have to agree with you that our august optimist is very optimistic, but I just don't think it's really what's happening. I think that we've basically, probably in the last 40 or 50 years, developed a culture of absolute opposites where there's visceral hatred that's going on between those who believe what they believe and those who don't. And I think a lot of that comes back to the simple lack of respect for your opposition and the people that you're supposed to be talking to, and you don't allow room for talk. I think that it really does, like Rachel said, create that whole going away from the amygdala. It's a real problem. I think it's been imbued by 24/7 news, and certainly the lack of truth in a lot of reporting, certainly the absolute hatred that can be put out by some of the people, especially on the left, on the right, rather, with Fox News, but you can hear it in other places, too. I just find it very difficult. I know people in all spectrums of politics, and you really can't talk to them. Very difficult. And I am an absolute liberal, so I have a lot of trouble with that.
Jack, thank you very much.
And it's very frustrating. It really is frustrating, but I don't see a solution to it coming down the road right now, especially I think they're chewing away at civil rights. I think a lot of the things that the professor said that we're making progress with are being pushed to the side and or trying to be denigrated from the people who disagree. It's a lack of respect for everybody.
Jack, thank you very much for the telephone call. Who wants to bat at this first?
Well, if I could just say, I think the problems in American society that need to be addressed are problems of injustice. Those are the problems that we need to address. So that's one thing. Second of all, and here I'm just echoing what Randy Kennedy said on your show the other day.
Yeah.
I mean, just imagine what it would be like now for politicians and citizens to speak to each other the way they used to speak to each other 50 years ago. It's unimaginable now. The last thing I would say is I do think that individuals in our lives are going to come up in situations in which we feel that we cannot be heard. But there are great social experiments happening across the United States. One of them is in places like Williams College and Amherst College, where colleges and universities are bringing to their campuses an increasingly diverse student body from many different backgrounds. And those students, I hope, are learning to speak to each other across the divides which are separating Americans. So I don't want to denigrate the experience of people who feel that they are not being heard. I think that's real. But I think we need to be able to identify places of hope and places of progress. Otherwise, the conversation about incivility is just a conversation about depression and resignation.
So, David Smith, let me let you comment on this by just setting it up with a question of Jack talking about this visceral hatred. So with that kind of mindset, are you optimistic? Do you find a place for optimism?
Well, I've never been accused of being an optimist. However, what I would say about our situation is that we see contradictory things that are present, and it's very difficult sometimes to have a clear perspective on proportion, because loud voices can seem like a much greater force than they actually are. And there is a lot of rancor that's foregrounded in our political life. I think that one could say that both the progressive tendencies, the movement toward inclusiveness, mutual respect, this desire to keep open the traditional sense of the American dream of allowing people to come here and to work hard and to advance socially and to be accepted, that's very strong in society, broadly speaking. But there is the opposite thing, too. There's a powerful push to create a very neo-medieval kind of hierarchical society with a permanent class of very rich people who are above the law, in essence, who are above the power of nation states, who get to have their way in the world to do whatever they want to with impunity. And they have entered into politics, and they're pushing for that kind of remaking of America. And some people are getting behind that. So both of those things are happening, and it's hard to know. Clearly, the numbers are with the masses of people, the progressive movement of our history, but it's hard to know which way it's going to work out, because a lot of unknown factors are going to determine things like elections, things like the strategic moment when either you implement policies or you don't implement policies. And there are good reasons, I think, to be worried about where we are.
We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll wrap up our series. We always welcome your comments, roundtable at WAMC.org. And again, you can find the full series at WAMC.org/roundtable. We'll be right back.
The president has something he's proposing.
Excuse
about
me.
1.2.
The difference, wait a minute.
There's no big difference.
Excuse me.
Here.
No, except
no
one balances and one doesn't. One has trillion-dollar deficits and one doesn't.
No, it doesn't. Look,
yeah,
that's
it does.
Just a matter of the number of years.
Welcome back to our discussion, Civility and Exercise in Getting Along. Agreeing to Disagree, Civility in Public Discourse, our third and final segment in this discussion. We have time for one or two more phone calls, and as we wrap up the program, we go to Anthony in Cooperstown, who's been waiting patiently for a long time on the phone. Anthony, thank you very much for joining the conversation.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
Listening to what's being said, it has been touching a lot of items. I've been sort of just brainstorming words that fit into the whole conversation. Marginalization of people just feel so marginalized by the hypocrisy of leaders who get elected, done one thing and do something else. And I think the politics of demonization more than anything elevates the disagreements to almost moral imperatives, and it just goes on and on. And I can't even put all these buzzwords together or these things together. I think you're touching on all of them, but I do believe that it's the demonization of the opposition. And even just hearing everyone constantly referring to Fox News as being the pit of evil, I mean, I am a lifelong independent, and I flip back and forth between any newses, and people just misconstrue news from commentary, and if you listen to commentary, you're going to hear people shouting.
Right.
I think there, in general, there's a great anxiety in the world, and it's just such a composite, and I don't know how it will be overcome. I mean, will a soft-spoken political leader ever take over without having to demonize an enemy in order to win an election? And I said it's a confusing panoply of emotions.
Thank you very much for the phone call. It's an interesting notion of whether you need the demonization. Do you think we are at that point?
I don't think that you need it. I think that it has been encouraged and too often rewarded. I think people are demoralized by the behavior of our politicians in Washington. I think the spectacle of seeing the Congress operating as rhetorical sparring and sneering at each other without a sense of cooperativeness. I think that's deeply demoralizing. The attacks on the president, the very ad hominem attacks sometimes, seem different from anything that I can recall hearing in my life before. And that, too, is demoralizing of a sense of shared purpose.
May I just say again? I think we want to resist the demoralization hypothesis. Yes, demonization is a way to get yourself elected. There's no doubt about it. I mentioned earlier our politics are increasingly polarized, but we're in a period which is an episodic period of the recognition of a crisis of civility. This is not the first time in American history, and it won't be the last time. And it's like a fever, which will go up and go up and go up. And I think it'll spike. And we will see, I can't say when, we'll see a movement away from it. I think the question that we need to, the issue that we need to address is how to keep it in perspective. Address issues of injustice, and those will go a long way in curing the crisis of civility. Deal with problems that are real. And that'll go a long way to addressing the problems of civility.
All right. We have time for one more call. We go to Judith and Socrates. Judith, go ahead.
Yeah, I kind of object to, I see this in the media all the time. There's kind of an equation between left and right. And I think that it really, really obscures the issue. The fact of the matter is, it is not the left and it is not Democrats, and I don't consider Democrats particularly left. But it is certainly not Democrats who are creating this situation. I mean, Mr. Smith or Dr. Smith have just said something about, you know, the demonization of the president. I mean, that is coming from the right, And that, and it, you know, to kind of equate the two is not only obscuring the issue. I think that what it ultimately does is render people powerless. They see it as the left and the right, or Democrats and Republicans. There's no public discourse, or there's no civil public discourse. It's not true.
Okay,
it's simply not true.
Take politics out of it.
I mean, there's no one who shouted out at Bush, you lie, and in fact, he did lie.
I think a lot of people did that. Though, well, let's take politics out of it. So let's take politics out of it. So left, right, bedamned. So take all that out of it, and just if I ask
but that's
you,
what you're talking about. You're
no,
talking about
no, we're
public
talking
forum.
About, no, we're talking about civility. So we're talking about public
in
discourse.
Public, in public forums.
Public discourse. We're talking about public discourse. So my question for you is, if you take politics out of it, do you feel that we as a society can have a discourse and talk about issues in a civil manner?
Well, I will say something for the right, and this is not the politicians on the right, but I will say that on the right, they did, in fact, agree to disagree. That is something that I don't see on the left, which I include myself in. So do I see that in public discourse? I see the possibility for, yes, I do see public discourse that is civil. But I think that it comes from the top down. I mean, I think that there are messages that we get literally from the top down that filter into the public, into the rest of us. And I saw it with Reagan. I see it now with the way that the Republicans are treating the president.
Okay.
I think that definitely creates a kind of climate that is uncivil. But do I think there can be, and that there is civil public discourse? Yes, I do think there is.
Judith, we're out of time.
Do I think that it's happening in Congress? No.
But
I don't think it's the fault of Democrats.
Judith, thank you very much. I don't think that point was actually made, but thank you very much for the call. She's talking about it coming from the top down, and we were you both made the point about how with great speed and perhaps more than any of us could have anticipated that issues have moved forward and that people have a lot more power perhaps than they're given credit for in the system to bring about change. Your comments.
So I appreciated the comment. I think what she said is actually largely right. I think the contemporary crisis of civility in the United States has largely been brought in this moment from the right. But I'm old enough to remember not only the things that were said about Bush, but the things that were said about Nixon. I'm old enough to remember the 1968 Democratic Convention when the incivility was largely on the left. And again, I'll just end my optimism with the following: I think what we see in the right is the death throes of an ideology that is really in crisis, and that's often when this demonization happens. So if you're a progressive, the good news is I think the arc of history is moving towards justice. And what we see on the right is a sign of that development.
David?
I agree with that. I would just say that I think that the left is pretty much invisible in our public discourse, and our public discourse is much impoverished by the absence of left perspectives involved in the debates, the arguments over issues of policy, of fundamental politics. I would also just say, since the political scientist has said that inequality is the central issue, I want to say that economic inequality, the lack of real economic opportunity for people, is fundamental. I would not want to make this an either-or, but I just wanted to underscore the economic part of it, because I think that is very much at the heart of the anxiety of Americans.
Our guests have been David Smith, the John Chandler Professor of English at Williams College,
and Austin Sarrett, the William Nelson Cromwell Professor of Jurisprudence and Political Science and Chair of Political Science at Amherst College. Gentlemen, I thank you so much for being with us and for adding so much to this discussion. I greatly appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Thank you. A reminder, you can hear our entire series, Civility and Exercise and Getting Along, all 3 hours by going to our website, wamc.org/roundtable, wamc.org/roundtable. The program is funded in part by Mass Humanities, state-based affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities, masshumanities.org. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.